Is President Trump right? That's a hard one. I want you to think about it before you respond. Or is there, in fact, ideas out there that would enable us to create millions of good-paying jobs as we move away from fossil fuels?
It's unsurprising that the response to any bold proposal that we have is to incite fear. To incite fear of loss, to incite fear of others, to incite fear of our future. But the only way we are going to get out of this situation is by choosing to be courageous.
AOC! It is Friday, December 7th, 2018. We are approaching the new year, everybody. Welcome to Raging Chicken's Out the Coop podcast. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Each week, I talk to our Capitol muckraker in chief, Sean Kitchen, about the good, the bad, and the ugly in state and national politics. Today's show, progressives led by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and other newly elected representatives are on the offensive for a Green New Deal. Writing in The Atlantic, Robinson Meyer calls the Green New Deal, quote, one of the most interesting and strategic left-wing policy interventions from the Democratic Party in years. I'd say decades. This past Monday, AOC joined Bernie Sanders, Bill McKibben, Van Jones, and others for a Facebook town hall sponsored by Bernie Sanders' office called Solving the Climate Crisis. The purpose of that? Turn up the heat for climate action. And yes, America, we can pay for it. But it will change everything. Hat tip to Naomi Klein and the Leap over that one. Then, as if to underscore the need for bold, courageous action, scientists announced on Wednesday that instead of declining, carbon emissions are reaching the highest levels in history. 2018 is going to top it all for the hottest year on record. And someone let Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez take over the communications department for the House Dems, please, like this week. This week, she burned Mike Huckabee by telling him on Twitter to leave the bullshit to Sarah Huckabee Sanders because she's much better at it. AOC also takes on living wage for congressional staffers, and Chuck Schumer is not very happy about it, and takes on the system of unpaid internships in D.C. Robert Mueller and leaking lion James Comey will be front and center today as Mueller is expected to show his cards with what he's got from Manafort and Cohen. Gonna get crazy! Former President George H.W. Bush passed away, and Trump receives accolades for not being an asshat during the funeral. That's where we are. Speaking of asshats, Milo Yiannopoulos is now more than $2 million in debt. Apparently, that troll strolled into the sunlight.
Blinded by the light.
Yes, exactly. He should have read The Hobbit. That's all I'm going to say. Republican Party ups the ante when it comes to breaking all political norms to maintain its own power. State GOP lawmakers are using the lame duck session to strip newly elected Democrats from being able to execute power. It all became real this week in Wisconsin, Michigan, and they're following the playbook established in 2016 down in North Carolina. We'll talk a little about that today. Today's PA focus, Lindsey Williams' story is starting to get some national traction with coverage from The Intercept. And surprise, surprise, there's echoes of Koch brother money. Philadelphia becomes the second biggest city in the nation to pass Fair Workweek legislation. The ordinance forces fast food, retail, and hotel employers to set predictable work schedules for their employees. That's right. No more just-in-time scheduling, folks. Imagine that. You can make sure you get your kids to school before you go to work. Today's last call. The Pentagon is scrambling to reorganize and make way for the Space Force. And today, December 7th, if you look at historically, on December 7th, 1972, it's when NASA launched the last crew to land on the moon with the Apollo 17 mission. A big shout out to our friends over at Inside 254 podcast. They've brought their podcast to a close after 46 episodes, right? They remarked, after 45, there's 46. Figure it out. You can check out their final episode and visit their archives at inside254.podbean.com. We will miss you, Colleen and Amanda. We will miss you. But they assure us all, let's be clear, it's not like they've given up struggling. Nope, just fighting in different forms. Big news, Wawa sells beer for the first time. Customers were waiting in line at Wawa and Chad's Ford as they released the Wawa Coffee Stout brewed by 2SP. I wonder if Sean likes Wawa coffee. We'll talk about it. And I'll tell you a little bit about Just Coffee. Just Coffee has got a promotion through the holidays. They're a great coffee company, co-op, fair trade, work with producers directly. And this week, tomorrow, Free Will, we'll have a double can release. The Tukutukutu, however you say that, it's a porter coming at 7%. And Eavesdrop, a sour IPA with Vic's Secret and El Dorado. That comes out on Saturday, 12 p.m. in both locations. I want to remind everybody, tune in to the Rick Smith Show on Free Speech TV this and every Saturday at 7 p.m. Eastern. You can stream the show live at freespeech.org. You can also tune in the Dish Network, DirecTV, or through the Free Speech TV app on Roku. And you can all go to the ricksmithshow.com. You can listen to his show every night from 7 to 11. All right, ricksmithshow.com. And after his Free Speech Show on Saturdays, you can stay around for overtime, kind of some post-show talk. I want to remind everybody, if we want a progressive future, if we want a Green New Deal, we need progressive media. You can help support Pull No Punches, homegrown progressive media today. Become a member of Raging Chicken Press for as little as $5 a month. Simply go to patreon.com/rcpress and choose your membership level. If you're not ready to become a member, no problem. Just go to ragingchickenpress.org and click on the big blue donate button in this right sidebar. With the 2018 midterm elections in the rearview mirror, we are now turning our attention to communities of resistance, building power, and progressive organizing for 2020. We need to make sure we keep the movement, the media, and the media, and the movement. The best way to do that, become a member of Raging Chicken by going to patreon.com/rcpress. And we will be taking on some new writers. And I know there's a couple people who have emailed me just a shout out. I've had a kind of like the past kind of month or so has just been just crazy hectic for a bunch of work stuff and bunch of other things. So the semester's almost over, so I'm going to kind of do a little reboot here. We'll be in contact with you. And we're looking to kind of do some new things coming in 2019, which we hope to be able to share with you fairly soon. But hang in there, folks. We're going to look for some more writing, some more reporting. Remember, support our work, patreon.com/rcpress today. Well, there we have it, Sean. It is yet another week. It is now 2 weeks removed from the turkey coma. And as we're pushing into the full holiday light season, here we are.
Yep.
Yeah, speaking of holiday lights, man, there somebody is certainly lighting it up down there in D.C. this week.
Yes. Yes, for sure. I guess we're going to get right into it. Ocasio-Cortez.
Yeah, the AOC, man. The
Where
AOC report. Your call.
Okay.
I'm
Thanks for
Sean
like dumping
today,
this
sorry.
On me.
Yeah.
I think a really good place to start is
let's one of the things start at the very beginning. It's a very good place to start. Yeah.
Sorry. I think we should start off with the internship stuff.
Yeah, I think that's huge.
I think one of the biggest issues she was this week was her taking on the system of interns and congressional pay in D.C. You know, she was explaining how she was going out the other night. And I guess at like one of the local dive bars, everyone there was pretty much a congressional staffer taking on a second job for her. Supplementary income, and then the system of unpaid internships, which yep. is a system of privilege pretty much in D.C.
Yeah, exactly. And so just to spell it out for you, everybody, so you basically, you know, most congressional staffers are there as unpaid interns, right? And for the prestige of it. But if you know, if you're Washington, D.C. is one of the, you know, kind of most expensive places to live in the country. And so the only way that you can choose to kind of work for 6 months or a year for an unpaid internship is if you've managed to kind of, I don't know, strike the lottery or you got rich parents. And that's been kind of the the increasing that's been on the increase in kind of last couple decades, where, you know, just people that every ordinary people, you know, individuals who want to get involved with politics are simply just priced out of it because they can't even afford to do it. So forget their qualifications. And so we saw with the release this week, Chuck Schumer putting out a call for interns, and all those interns have a wonderful opportunity to come and work for free. Right. And hopefully bring your rich parents with you who will support you, so then they can become our next round of donors. Right. So, I mean, that's not in the ad, but just the kind of like the unpaid internship with wonderful opportunities. And AOC said, no way.
Yeah, no. And what it does is, I mean, $15 an hour is nowhere near what you can pay someone living in
right.
D.C. But I mean, it's pretty much what I got here in Harrisburg as a paid intern. I mean, it allows people, like, paid internships allow people who do not have the opportunity to do stuff, you know, by moving across the state or moving into a different region. I mean, it gives people who typically can't afford that stuff an opportunity to afford that and actually do stuff and do something that is, like, worthwhile.
Yeah, let's recall, like, $15 an hour is not a good living. $15 an hour is a barely living wage,
yeah. Right?
That's what we're talking about.
Yeah.
So if you can't have the people that are actually being brought in, right, brought in to staff congressional offices.
And $15 an hour is nowhere near subsistence in D.C.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. But, I mean, and it's been one thing after another this week. It's been, you know, talking about the unpaid internships there. And the fact is that she is continuing to build a power base. And, you know, I'm always a little bit like, you know this. We talked a little about this beforehand. I'm very anti-celebrity, right? I could care less what happens with celebrities and, like, for their lives and all that kind of stuff, Inside Edition, all that bullshit, I just can't stand. And I don't like the fact that we turn certain politicians into celebrities either. I don't like that at all, because I think it kind of is – it really mistakes, like – personality for social movements and all sorts of things like this. And I've been very, very resistant to hopping on the kind of the AOC kind of celebrity bandwagon, just because I worry about that dynamic. But I gotta say, man, she's freaking amazing. And everything, and she's continued to build a power base. And it's not just her, right? I mean, she's been really, she's like a stand-in for this new crop of newly elected representatives, primarily women, right? Kind of primarily women of color, right? Who are just freaking tearing it up and building a power base before they've even stepped foot in their office. Their term hasn't even started yet.
Yeah,
it's amazing.
I mean, and she's like, I mean, she's going for the Ways and Means Committee.
Yes.
Which is just like something that is like wholly unprecedented. And I mean, it's a shot across the bow.
With
Democratic leadership. I mean, Nancy Pelosi promised to give progressive more seats on these committees like Ways and Means. And here she is jumping into it, demanding as a 29-year-old a committee spot on that. One of the most powerful committees in the House.
Exactly. And this matters, right? So we talked a little bit about this last week on the podcast, in reference to kind of how David Dayan has broken down how to think strategically about committee assignments and stuff. Because this is the stuff that is so far outside the kind of mainstream kind of discussions of the way politics work, but is nonetheless absolutely critical when it comes to actually pulling the levers of power. So because you have a lot of folks that were in Democratic leadership that came out of the, you know, they came out of the 1960s, they came out of the like those kind of struggles and stuff, one of the most highly sought committee assignments was to the judiciary, right? In part because the role that the Supreme Court played in civil rights and women's rights, right? And LGBTQ rights, right? Is that the court stuff in the judiciary was kind of like a high profile, highly sought after in the progressive wing. In the meantime, what was less sought after were things like Ways and Means and kind of budget committees, finance committees, things that were kind of, you know, considered to be kind of like boring, right? Yet it's those boring committees, not that the judiciary is not important, but the boring committees is where decisions about how money can get spent and how things can be allocated actually originate. And for any piece of legislation that's going to require expenditures, for example, Medicare for All, right, has to go through those committees. So when to see AOC, right, make a play to go on the Ways and Means Committee tells me that she's for real, right? That not only is she an amazing politician, right? Not only has she kind of like helped build a movement and is can articulate issues better than everyone I've seen in recent memory. But she understands, right? And she's got people around her who are helping her understand and supporting that understanding that you're going to go after the levers of power, not simply the high profile, right? And that is something, for example, that we did not see in someone like Barack Obama, right? When he went through the kind of Senate and things like this, we see that definitely happening with AOC. So all kudos to her, because that's like, you know, that's just huge.
Yeah. No, and I mean, look at, we were also talking about this beforehand. I mean, like, look at, and I'll say, I'll keep on saying this until like it's being a dead horse, but I mean, her ability to connect with millennials, I mean, Sanders has, you know, sort of figured that out. I mean, like, he has a really good team, and, but like, here is a millennial, like AOC, actually being able to interact with millennials on stuff like Instagram or Snapchat, which is like platforms that like not a lot of people use besides that millennial. Like I can't use Instagram for my life, but like somehow, like I know people who like just simple friends of mine who post up pictures and get hundreds of likes.
Right.
And they're a few years younger than me. And or like, but she's still in that generation that can reach out on Instagram and really utilize social media platforms that others don't.
Right. And it's like, you know, we were talking about before before going on the show today, you know, I think that, look, she is like in the Sanders vein in terms of communication and strategy. And what I meant by, you know, is Sanders is kind of like talk directly, talk about issues, how to build a movement, how to kind of reach directly to constituents. And he's kind of very much the model in the 20th century. Like AOC is the 21st century kind of direction, where she's embedded with different political cultures. She's embedded with, you know, like you said, different media cultures and understandings of how to do this communication and carrying those messages forward. And she's more skilled than I've, like, again, like I said, than any politician I've seen in ages. So
I'm going to make a shameless like DSA plug here, but like one of the things that DSA members are known for are their ability to use social media and things like Twitter in such a like snarky or they know how to utilize like a Twitter as a platform to get their point across. I mean, DSA Twitter is a pretty fascinating community. And I mean, but you look at like, and like different like left communities on Twitter. I mean, like her, the way that she can come in and just be like, getting an argument with Mike Huckabee, and I was like, listen, leave the lying to your daughter. She's a lot better at it than you. I mean, to do that like on Twitter is just like,
yep,
slaying.
No, totally.
I mean, she's just slaying people on Twitter, like, and it's amazing because it's right. they don't get it.
No, and I think that, you know, I'm thinking about, you know, one of the things that after the what was it, right before the election or right after the election? Right before the election, is that Elizabeth Warren gave that one speech, right? Oh, it was after the kind of Supreme Court hearings for Kavanaugh, right? Elizabeth Warren said that, you know, she said, I'm not going to say I'm not going to be angry. Damn right I'm angry. I'm going to use that anger. Right. And I love that line that comes out. And what we see with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is that we see that kind of like aggressiveness. Right. That is not gendered male, if you know what I mean. Right. Because there's a certain kind of aggressiveness that is kind of like, you know, that we see on the right wing and in certain sectors of the left, which is this kind of male aggression. This is a different kind of assertiveness and aggressiveness about politics that is not going to kind of like, you know, sit back and kind of play nice. And as you were saying, that's one of the things that she said. I wasn't elected to come here and play nice. And yeah. I think that is the kind of message that is so important that we see in our politics. If you want to get kind of the next generation involved, that's how you do it right there.
Yeah. And then also putting their orientation on blast.
Yeah. That's been, oh my God.
I mean, another thing, like, I mean, it's, we were joking, like, you know, changing this for a segment to just recapping everything AOC does. But like, I mean, the fact that they were in a orientation meeting with, CEOs, Gary Cohn, four CEOs, and then no labor leaders at all. It shows you the disconnect between labor and like the parties up there.
Yep. Yep. That's absolutely right. You know, and that's, this is what we've been saying for like, a while. You got, you know, I mean, they're going to have to just get out of the way at some point.
Yeah. I mean, it's, for me, it seems like there's a large disconnect between labor and like the Democratic Party up on, and especially in DC, but it's like, I mean, it's almost stunning because there's not that type of disconnect between labor and the Democratic Party, like in the state of Pennsylvania.
Right.
It's, I mean, yeah. So,
well, it's like, again, you talk about, you know, I mean, again, I don't want to get too into the weeds on kind of on the sidebar, but it's like, you know, a lot of it has to do with just so the internal politics of, and, you know, the same kind of stuff that you're seeing in the Democratic Party, you have an internal politics that happens within labor, right? I mean, the fact is that if you look at some of the most progressive, most interesting campaigns that are happening in the labor movement right now, it's very similar to what we just see with, the, you know, AOC and those folks coming forward. It's like, we have different reference points. The people who are in positions of power and labor represent a much kind of older view and a much wider view, right, of labor. That's why I think, for example, like an organization like SEIU, right, and again, with all the complications and people can raise questions and concerns about SEIU, but SEIU has been out in front of on so many different struggles, in part because it's looking like down the road about what are the emerging sectors, right, by targeting the service sector, for example, as opposed to kind of just trying to hold on to existing power structures. That's enabled them to see different things and think about movements in different ways.
Yeah.
And that's different from, for example, like with the building trades, right, where you're about kind of trying to preserve particular jobs in particular locations.
Like clean coal.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So, you know, and again, as you, so we're going to see this stuff play itself out in a lot of ways. And I think that, you know, it's to the value of labor to kind of like throw in their hat with people like AOC, right, and these emerging folks and thinking about building movements, you know. I'm going to use this as an opportunity. I'm going to give a shout out to Labor Notes right now. If you are interested in labor and you don't know about Labor Notes, go to labornotes.org. They are it's a publication that has been around. It's more than a publication, but it's a publication that's been around for decades that represents rank and file struggle. I mean, when I was first, you know, getting involved with the labor movement, Labor Notes was always a place that I would go to or that I learned. Thank God somebody showed it to me at one point, that were the rank and file members arguing for kind of a militant democratic unionism. Right. And they're still around. They do all sorts of amazing trainings. They do all sorts of workshops, like periodically. They have a biannual, I guess, conference out in Chicago. But it's like that kind of like approach of looking at the focus on workers and their struggles and their democratic union and militant unionism that pairs really, really well with the kind of politics that we see coming out from AOC and so on. But
yeah,
that's my plug. I got lots of plugs today, I think. So that's it. One of the things that I think, you know, with AOC, like once again, is that we saw, I mean, I don't know how, if you watched any of this or saw any of this of the town hall that was put on by Bernie Sanders this week.
I did not.
So it's like his whole thing was called, it was called Solving the Climate Crisis. This is like the fourth, like, I think it was a Facebook town hall. I'm sure it was broadcast elsewhere too as well. Facebook town hall that brought in people like Bill McKibben and Van Jones, a bunch of other kind of environmental organizations. And of course, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And you heard her. That was a segment right in today's opening segment, or opening music. The little clip was from her answering Bernie Sanders' first question when she was just introduced, right? And that's where she started. And it just got better after that. But it was absolutely kind of critical in terms of being out in front on this. It's because, of course, we saw, like, just after the election, one of the first things that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez made news about down in D.C. was that she joined the folks from the Sunrise Movement in occupying Nancy Pelosi's office, right, demanding this kind of this new committee for a new Green Deal, right? And go ahead, sorry.
Oh, no, I was going to say it's amazing seeing how far Sunrise Movement has come within this since like the springtime.
Yeah, you had some association with that, right? I mean, you had there was some kind of like video that you posted that was kind of like early.
I wasn't going to be doing a shameless plug here. Like, I wasn't plugging my own stuff.
No, I'm doing it for you because I think – no, but that was – again, that – I'm sorry, but Rose – what was Rose's last name?
Strauss. So, like, you see her in the videos and pictures down in D.C., like, in Pelosi's office calling these people out. But like, I remember like getting in contact with a director of a local Sunrise chapter out here in Pennsylvania, and they were doing the same thing. Like, they were going around to the Wagner town halls and tracking him there and asking these questions. But I remember like talking to one of the local directors, organizers, about like their strategy and you know, just getting doing stuff in Pennsylvania. And no, it's amazing seeing how far they've come since like that like preliminary talk back in like March, pretty much.
Yeah. Now, and they had been around for a while before then. But that was kind of like their like kind of seemed like a big national launch in yeah. some ways.
No, and I mean like the and then the Wagner video, which is like still it's my claim to fame.
Yeah, it is. It is. It is. See how long you can ride that one, Sean.
Oh, it's on the resume.
There's a direct link to the video. Right. It's posted on YouTube, like, but only for people who can access it through my resume. I'm kidding. One of the things I want to point to
even after that, they took it, they like ran with it. I mean, their own videos and stuff like that. They had people taking the video that there. And no, I mean, it's amazing seeing now like that next step of them really just bursting onto the scene. With this Green New Deal activism down in D.C.
Yeah, and we're seeing this stuff all over the place. You know what I mean?
I mean, they're becoming a household name at this point for like any type of progressive.
But and you think about what you see the Sunrise Movement. The Sunrise Movement is doing the same kind of stuff that we see happening in the, you know, ever since Trump was elected. You see these organizations start really thinking directly about power and policy, which is freaking awesome. The Green New Deal is so important for a few reasons, right? For those people who have not read it, Naomi Klein's This Changes Everything, read it. Because Naomi Klein has been, I mean, I'm telling you, this is why I am huge fan, like an enormous fan of Naomi Klein. If I talk about any, you know, if I had to put people that I would consider like, you know, in my celebrity class, Naomi Klein would be one of them, right? But it's well-deserved. I mean, in part because she has been kind of like right on the cusp of each major kind of like movement breakout. That has been there from her book No Logo, right? That was right kind of as a global justice movement was emerging in 1999, 2000. Her book had preceded that, right? Because she had been following this stuff for a long time. This Changes Everything, that book about kind of climate change and a book about social movements is right on the money. And one of the things that that Naomi Klein says that you see Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez echoing in slight kind of ways, not, you know, not like directly citing per se, but I mean, echoing exactly is the title of Naomi Klein's book, right? And Naomi Klein's book, This Changes Everything, is basically what she argues in that book in a much more condensed version is that, look, you cannot like addressing climate change today is not simply about swapping out your light bulbs for LEDs. Right. The whole idea of corporate public partnership that kind of like the big greens have been arguing for a while that, hey, you know, you don't have to change your lifestyle. You just need to swap out some things here. And it's gonna be fine. No. In order to address our climate crisis, the impending climate crisis, it's going to require fundamentally changing things.
And yeah, what is you don't see Sierra Club saying that.
No. And what is at the core of that change is that you can no longer have like runaway market fundamentalism, runaway neoliberal economics, runaway kind of neoliberal capitalism, and be able to save the planet, the same thing. Those two are mutually exclusive now. And what you see, what kind of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez said, right, about kind of you need bold action, is borne out exactly in what kind of Naomi Klein was arguing. So let me give you an example. So this is from Naomi Klein just had a piece that was published in The Intercept. It's called The Game-Changing Promise of a Green New Deal, where she kind of runs through some of her arguments there. But I want to read this one part that she kind of gives us a frame to thinking about what this Green New Deal does. So there's one. The Green New Deal targets 2020, January 2020, where the plan is going to be released. And this is her argument. She says that that early 2020 deadline is important. It means that the contours of the Green New Deal would be complete by the next U.S. election cycle, and any politician wanting to be taken seriously as a progressive champion would need to adopt it as a centerpiece to their platform. If that happened and the party running on a sweeping Green New Deal retook the White House and the Senate in 2020, then there would actually be time left on the climate clock to meet the harsh targets laid out in the recent IPCC report, which told us that we have a mere 12 years to cut fossil fuel emissions by a head-spinning 45%. Pulling that off, the report summary states in its first sentence, is not possible with singular policies like carbon taxes. Rather, what is needed is, quote, rapid, far-reaching, and unprecedented changes in all aspects of society. By giving the committee a mandate that connects the dots between energy, transportation, housing, and construction, as well as healthcare, living wages, a jobs guarantee, and the urgent imperative to battle racial and gender injustice, the Green New Deal plan would be mapping precisely that kind of far-reaching change. This is not a piecemeal approach that trains a water gun on a blazing fire, but a comprehensive and holistic plan to actually put the fire out. And that right there, my friends, is what the Green New Deal promise is. And if you watch that video, and there's a link in our show notes today, if you watch that video from the town hall and listen to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez talk a little bit more about that program, that Green New Deal, and Bernie Sanders talk about that Green New Deal, that's exactly what they're talking about. And so we can either go one of two directions. We could go to our dystopian future, right, which is going to be led by plutocrats racing to Mars, or we can actually have this bold action that offers in one fell swoop an opportunity to address everything at once, right? And these opportunities do not come on, right? Do not come very often. And the Green New Deal, with its framing again as a New Deal, just like the previous New Deal did, is an opportunity to have that kind of bold action. And let's recall, is what Ocasio-Cortez says in that town hall too. She said, look, when the New Deal, because everyone wants to say, we can't pay for it, it's too expensive. When the New Deal was put in place, let's remember this. Unemployment was like, 30% plus, right? The economy had just crashed, right? We had just emerged, and we're about to emerge from one world war, and we're heading into a second, right? Those things happened when the economy had crashed, which war was unprecedented, where there was all sorts of disruptions all throughout the economy, right? That's when the New Deal was put into place. Not when times were everyone was flush with cash. And that was also at a time, by the way, which billionaires had sought to take over our economy and take everything for themselves, right? Just like we have right now. So in some ways, there's echoes here. Right. The echoes of the early 20th century are being echoed in the early 21st century. We have a 100-year opportunity here to address this. And these folks, this is our only hope right now, if you ask me. And, 100%, we're going to be covering this Green New Deal and each step of the way precisely because of this, because it's our path to the future, or at least a future that I want to live in.
Yeah. So.
I'm excited, John. I really am. I mean, this is
I mean, I think we have the opportunity with that legislation to pound it home. And I think it's going to provide a roadmap to get people elected.
Everything about this is like, it speaks to that, right? Just exactly as Klein says in that piece, the timing is so well thought out, right? Yeah. Is that it's not being put forward. Oh, just here's like another random plan. No, it's a power play.
And we're also at the same time, all this stuff's intertwined. And at the same time, Democrats are promising to make voter rights issues front and center.
Exactly.
First bill is going to be, voter integrity of national elections.
Absolutely. Right. Green New Deal. Like this is, let's take those two pieces out for a second. The Green New Deal, why this is so important as a strategy, right, is because it's not just like, here's something about the environment, and here's something that's about voter suppression and voting rights. No. It's to say this is because our environment, for example, disproportionately impacts people of color, poor folks, working class folks. Right. They have to be on the front lines and have full access to the democratic process precisely because the decisions that are made are going to affect them most dramatically. So therefore, the voter suppression that we see in North Carolina, in Wisconsin, in Michigan, and across the country, right? That you go to the Brennan Center's reports on this stuff. Looking at that, that has to be rolled back, and that could only happen, right, with a strong Democratic majority, right? The kind of the full trifecta at the national level, right? And with this at its forefront, there's a consistent logic about where these things fit together. It's not piecemeal. It is one whole coherent package that offers us a promise. So, man, I'm excited. Look, I mean, I'm not the one to kind of, be all happy about stuff all the time and think it's just great, right? I'm definitely more on the cynical dystopian angle of stuff. But I don't know, man. I'm getting on board the train.
Nice.
Again. Yeah, but so there's that. But so it's all sorts of exciting there. We will continue to follow this. Other news coming out of D.C. this week, of course, later today, we're supposed to hear from Robert Mueller's committee. He's basically going to kind of give up the goods on what he's got on Manafort and use basically what has happened when he's done in these other reports is say, okay, we're pulling our plea agreement with Manafort. And this is the sentencing guideline. This is why we're doing this, and this is how he's not cooperating. So apparently he's going to lay that all out, and that's going to happen with Michael Cohen too as well. So the pressure is going to ratchet up in the White House, and I'm sure it's going to squeeze out the crazy, man.
The Twitter account is just going on fire right now.
Yeah, how many you had, like, 5 tweets before 6 o'clock this morning or something?
Before,
like
8:30.
Before 8:30. Oh, my God.
This is my favorite tweet so far.
Okay.
We will be doing a major counter report to the Mueller report. This should never again be allowed to happen to a future president of the United States! ! So, and that was sent out at 9:56 this morning. So,
yeah, if you go to the Hill, I'm sure you're going to see this everywhere. But the Hill has this. The title of their thing is "Trump launches Twitter tirade at Mueller ahead of expected Manafort filing," and they've got all the tweets embedded there. It's kind of a nice little read. It's probably like the most that Trump has written in a while, and. It's kind of funny, and you can literally see the crazy ooze coming out of him.
It's like the dog wags or the tail wags the dog. I mean, you could just see with like these type of like outbursts, like you know something's going to happen, and to boot, John Kelly's going to be resigning within the next couple of days.
There you go, man. But it is crazy. I mean, look, we should also remember. Right.
It's going to be a very bad few days for the Trump administration.
Well, but I will say this. Let's also not forget, right, that this not only does this represent proof that Trump, that this is really having effect on Trump and what they expect, because they probably have some idea about what's coming out.
They have a really good idea on what's coming out.
Yeah. And so they're kind of like, he is squirming in there. And like what Sean was saying before, I wouldn't be surprised the guy has a stroke before it's all over with. I you could see that kind of pressure.
I mean, I could see any thing happening. Either he has a stroke and just, I don't know. I don't want to wish a stroke on someone, but
that's
you can see him having an aneurysm and his brain just explodes out of his eyes because of this.
Right.
That is a very real possibility.
Right. But let's also, this is what I'm going to say. This is my word of caution, right? Because I physically am elated that this stuff is coming out, and it makes me feel good when I see that they are actually being impacted by this stuff. However, as I have that watching these tweets, let's also remember this is how Trump gets out in front of stuff, right? Yeah. He just goes on kind of crazy tirades, right? And produces all this media and gets his base ramped up, right? So this is him. If you look at those tweets, I look at those tweets very much. Yes, he's under stress, things like that, but it is like the bugle call, right, to the troops to kind of bring out the crazy. So yeah. That's what's being prepared right now. So we should all be prepared for that.
Yes. And then I guess what should we do next?
Well, we can say George H.W. Bush died.
Rest in peace.
Move on. And then I did think it was funny that, you know, that there were like, you know, again, once again, commentators for CNN and things like this are like saying, oh, the president, blah, 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 just because Trump wasn't a complete freaking idiot or start like bring out his phone and tweeting during the ceremony, he somehow like, you know, raised the presidential. But whatever. I'm so bored of
talking
about
that.
This
is not normal.
Right. Exactly.
It's not normal that we have to praise someone for not being a right. dickhead at a funeral.
Exactly. You don't even know how to not be an asshole at a funeral. I mean, come on, then you shouldn't be whatever. So I'm not explaining. But my one bit of appreciation of seeing the downfall of someone else was this week the right wing, horrible, horrific right wing troll Milo Yiannopoulos. Turns out, guy is more than $2 million in debt. Apparently, the Mercers have cut ties with him. That was the main funders, his main funders, and all these other right wing people that were propping him up by just kind of feeding him cash so he can be a complete dick.
you see what happens when you lose your Twitter account?
Yeah, exactly. And so his debts are being called in now, and apparently he's not too happy about it. So see ya, Milo.
Speaking about the Mercers.
Yeah, speaking of the Mercers, this is how we're going to close this out, which will lead us into our discussion about Pennsylvania in our next segment.
So the Mercers, you know, they like to fund a lot of right-wing things in this country. You know, Breitbart being one of them. Milo Yiannopoulos is another. But a lot of people don't realize they're also like huge funders of the State Policy Network organizations.
Right.
So like the Goldwater Institute, Illinois Policy Center – the Mackinac Center for Public Policy, you know, like all these right wing groups that are pushing these rollbacks right now in Wisconsin, Michigan are all funded by the Mercers.
Yep.
And these are the people that are spearheading. If you haven't seen what's going on, Republicans are trying to just undo the 20th century in Wisconsin and Michigan simply because they lost elections. And they don't want the Democrat governors to do anything, have any shot of an effective government when changing of power happens. And this just shows you that these people are just straight up fascists with a capital F.
Yep.
They lost an election, so now they're doing everything they can do to prevent the incoming administration from being anything near effective. And these are the lab states for the Koch brothers.
That's right. And you look at, and it's been a pattern of this. And I think that,
Pennsylvania is also a lab state.
We've just had
the fortunate luck that there were still enough union friendly Republicans in the legislature to stop Pennsylvania becoming a right to work state and stuff like that.
Well, we can't look. We were on the cusp of it. I think if the Corbett administration, when Tom Corbett was governor, if that administration had been a little bit more competent and they had had their ducks a little bit more in a row, then we'd be right there with them.
I don't think so.
You don't think so?
There were enough Republicans to thwart that the Senate.
All right, I'll take your word for it, but I don't.
But that firewall is pretty much gone. I mean, back in 2010, 2011.
Right.
They went out with the new maps in 2012 and really couldn't do anything because Corbett was just so shitty. But yeah. No, I mean, we were one of those lab states, though, to get back on topic. Like with the Commonwealth Foundation, and they were successful in passing a lot of legislation over the past decade, but you know they never got the Pennsylvania to become a right-to-work state or go after public sector unions in the way that they wanted to.
Right. I mean, it says Ari Berman has been reporting on this, and he's been kind of breaking this stuff down of late and basically saying, like, look, you know, here you've got in North Carolina, what we're seeing this new pattern. And again, these like Koch brother funded Mercer kind of money funded think tanks and institutions and things like this are basically they set the playbooks and they're thinking about, again, how you kind of hold on to power a long time systematically. And so we saw in 2016, like after North Carolina had kind of done a full frontal assault on voting rights and stuff in the aftermath of the Tea Party victories in 2016, right? Democrats had clawed back some of that power. And so the Republicans in the state of North Carolina used the lame duck session as a way to kind of like limiting the power of the incoming governor. And so either that was the initial test or enough people took notice where that now that is being kind of shipped out as kind of a process. So we see happening, you know, Michigan and Wisconsin were just the two most prevalent examples of that this week. But, you know, what Ari Berman and others are saying now is like that's what we should be expecting. To happen to kind of move on here. Because I mean, you're talking about when, like in Wisconsin, you're talking about saying, like putting restrictions on the power of the incoming governor, Tony Evers, right? By putting a legislative veto over any effort to ban guns from the state capitol, eliminate the office of the Solicitor General, establish new legislative power for the Senate to hire their own lawyers, a whole bunch of things like this. And Michigan's having to cut paid sick leave and repeal minimum wage increases in these lame duck sessions, right? Again, that whole idea about things like, well, this is not how things are done, that's being just thrown to the wind. Like, if anything, what the lesson for the Republican Party about the Tea Party elections and then the Trump victory have been, look, breaking social mores, right, doesn't matter.
Right? And the bills that they're pushing, especially in Michigan, come from the Mackinac Center.
Yep. Exactly.
And like this, which is a state policy network funded group. And it's the same, it's in the same family of think tanks as the Commonwealth Foundation. And just like, you know, last month we were talking about like the Mackinac Center was, you know, going after, was handing over legislation, model legislation to Pennsylvania, like state senators. You know, obviously it's an outgoing term, but I mean, this is stuff they're going to be considering for next year, you know, legislation in a post Janus world. And the Mackinac Center is just handing over their model bills to the people in these states.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, so that leads us well into our section on Pennsylvania. So let's take a quick break. Allow Sean to actually eat some more popcorn as he's waited for the Manafort stuff to drop. and we'll be back right after this. We want to remind everybody the way that you can help support this podcast, the way you can support the reporting we do at Raging Chicken Press, and the way that you can support progressive media in this state, right, is by becoming a member of Raging Chicken Press. Go to patreon.com/RCPress today. We'll be right back after this quick break.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1907. That was the day that troops from the 22nd Infantry arrived in Goldfield, Nevada, on the orders from President Teddy Roosevelt. 1,900 gold miners organized by the Western Federation of Miners were on strike. They walked out in late November when cash-strapped mine operators began paying them in scrip. Local 77 held considerable power in the mines and the town for 2 years. They had won the 8-hour day both for their members and established it as an industrial standard throughout Goldfield. By 1907, the mine operators and Nevada Governor John T. Sparks had enough. Wobblies were on trial elsewhere, falsely accused of murdering Idaho Governor Frank Stoutenberg for his role in the 1899 miner strike in Coeur d'Alene. Many miners in Goldfield had been active in that strike. Sparks feared that with no force capable of protecting the operators, another mine war was inevitable. The mine owners convinced Sparks that the miners were heavily armed and capable of dynamiting mine property. At the same time, the operators tried to provoke local 77 miners to engage in illegal activities for which they could be arrested. They also used the financial panic of 1907 to pay workers in scrip and as a pretext to smash the union, even though the gold standard remained relatively stable. The owners then made their moves. They reduced wages and threatened workers with mass firings and strike breakers. But the union remained disciplined and peaceful during the strike. It was clear by the following March that the presence of federal troops gave the mine owners the impetus they needed to drive local 77 miners out of the mines and out of Goldfield.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to Raging Chicken's Out the Coop podcast. And this just in, everybody, just in case you didn't know, Donald Trump has recently tweeted, fake news, enemy of the people. Well, here we are sitting in the chairs of the enemy. Then here we go. Oh, there you have it. But just came up. I just saw this. I mean, tweeted this like 14 hours ago. But still, here you go. Fake news. Enemy of the people. Once again, of course, he's got to do that ahead of what's about to be released. But anyways, so we were talking about right before the break, we're talking about what's been happening in state capitals across the country and about the ways that some, say, the Mackinac Center and some of these other institutions have been supporting these things. And so, you know, that stuff has never been too far from home. And sure enough, once again, we see this at the direct connections here to Pennsylvania. So, Sean, what's going on?
So The Intercept has picked up on Lindsay Williams' story, which pretty much lays out the law that lays it out that like the Republicans are not willing to lose a seat by all means necessary, or it's like hold on to a seat by all means necessary. And they're using a residency issue that Lindsay Williams was not living in a state within such a tight window that they're trying not to seat her. That she's barely outside of the state's constitutionally mandated residency issue, right? Mm-hmm. And Republicans tried challenging this in the towards the end of the election, but they were months past the deadline, right? Chuck Pascal, who's active within the progressive community, is Lindsay's election lawyer, pretty much. And his argument was, they had a window to challenge this, and this was pre-primary. They missed that window. Therefore, she stays on the ballot, right? And it's pretty much the same argument here. If she's able to stay on the ballot, she should be able to be able to serve. And Republicans are trying to force her to prove her residency, which it's like right around, in and around, like the constitutionally mandated time. And they're threatening not to seat her. What they're doing is unprecedented with this. It's also highly misogynistic mm-hmm. to put this woman, 35-year-old woman, through a test to see if she's worthy enough to serve in the Pennsylvania legislature. The Democrats don't see this as Republicans actually going through with this. They're just pandering to their base. But even that they're subjugating someone to go through this simply to prove that they can serve in Pennsylvania is absolute bullshit.
Yeah, and there seems to be – I mean, this is a perfect example.
I mean, this is like blatant misogynistic politics at its worst, in my opinion. Like the optics of this, you know, of forcing a woman to go through a test like this just to prove that she could serve in a chamber that is also, like, you know, not very well represented by women.
Yep. Absolutely. And this is like – and in terms – as far as I can tell, right, I mean, there's virtually no there of any of this.
No, this is like, this has never happened before.
Right.
Like,
this is crazy.
Yeah. So the connection is some of the things that has happened. It's that, sorry, I'm just trying to bring something up that like one of the couple of the groups that like were heavily investing in this race were like the Commonwealth Foundation. People associate with the Commonwealth Foundation, right? Mm-hmm. And these dark money groups associated with the Koch brother money was Students First, which is ran by three hedge fund managers outside in Bryn Mawr, Pennsylvania, outside of Philadelphia. Very pro charter school, also has connections to Betsy DeVos's Americans for Children. And then they dumped over $1 million into the Commonwealth Leadership Fund, which is ran by Matt Briere from the Commonwealth Foundation. Mm-hmm. And they also gave her opponent $100,000, Jeremy Schaefer. They also dumped money into that race. And Briere's group spent $350,000 in 9 races in the final weeks in the Pennsylvania elections. And one of his group, a lot of independent expenditures they made, were like these red baiting literature going out against Lindsay Williams about her being a socialist and stuff like that.
It's crazy, man.
Yeah.
It's crazy. And this is, you know, we're going to see more of this stuff. I was.
They spent $60,000 in the final weeks, $65,000 in mailers and radio spots.
So let me ask you this. I mean, in terms of, like, you know, we've been talking about like tails wagging dogs today, right? So is this the kind of thing that, say, you would expect, say, Jake Corman right, and stuff to do this on his own, right? Or does this really reek of the money driving the agenda?
I don't know. It could be anything. This could be Scarnati just being a total asshole.
Or Scarnati. Yeah, sorry. Yeah.
Doing it to rile up the base. I mean, you look at how close. I mean, she only won by like a half a percentage point. And that was a seat they held on to for a while. It's first time in flipping over to a Democrat in such a long time. No, since like in the post gerrymandering. Since it's the Senate district. So since those maps have been gerrymandered, she kind of broke that gerrymander. And I mean, I don't know. There could be a whole host of things.
Yep. Yeah, we'll see. And I love the fact that
this could also be Scarnati getting back at Democrats over the issues with the Catholic Church.
Yeah, it's so hard to say. It's so hard to say what's kind of motivating this, but we certainly know that there's enough money around to help support this. So that's
interesting. And definitely fund an election against her and hold on to that seat.
Yeah, now, and it's interesting that, you know, and Scarnati, I love the fact that the final line of the Intercept article is that Scarnati did not reply to any reply with comment when in touch with him. Has he been out in front at all about kind of like advocating for this or talking about what they're trying to do? I mean, to what extent are they trying to make this a political, like a political rallying point in addition to just trying to get Williams unseated?
I think they're just trying to get her unseated or they're just placating to their base. Mm-hmm. Like this was an illegitimate election or something like that.
Well, we shall see. We shall see, folks. I mean, this is going to be this will, it's like one more step in this direction, one more struggle. And you know, I was thinking about this case in connection with what we've been seeing with the lame duck sessions going on, and I can't remember if it was Marcy Wheeler or that Sam Cedar was talking about the Majority Report this week, or if it was, I don't know. I don't remember who it was, but it was one of these discussions that said, you know, there had been a certain sense in progressive circles, right? That, we could rest for like 3 days before going back, like after the midterm elections. That was such a big, and you know, and they carried on for a while before you actually saw the full extent of the Democratic victories in the nationwide. And this has also happened at state houses. What this person said, I wish I could remember who was saying it, but it was basically saying, no, if there's any takeaway, is that there is no rest. Right. Which means all the more reason why the organizations have to grow. Right. Because this is not the kind of thing the movement is going to require more people where we can distribute the labor around a little bit more, because the Republicans have what seems to be an unhindered flow of money to help support these kind of efforts. And then we have to be able to pay attention to them so that we can respond to them, which is what we try to do. But that's all of us there. So meanwhile, on the other end of the state, major victory this week, Sean.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, out in Philadelphia.
What's that?
I don't know. People don't have to kind of like have their cell phone on them all time to figure if they have to show up to work in the next 15 minutes. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, so Philadelphia City Council passed the Fair Work Week legislation, which is forced hotels, retailers, and fast food places to actually give their employees a 2-week set schedule.
Imagine that.
In 2018, that we have to regulate that.
It's like, dude, it's like so old fashioned, though. It's like,
I mean, but like capitalism is going to treat these people correctly, and we just have to wait for the invisible hand of capitalism to do this. And there's no need for municipalities to burden whole industries on treating their workers with like respect and dignity. We shouldn't be doing that.
The next thing you're going to tell me is like, I can't have my Uber. But I mean, go ahead. Sorry.
And Seth Groove, Republican out here in York County, has had legislation in the past that would pass preemption bills to stop Philadelphia from regulating these labor laws like that.
And yet, here we go. We did. It was interesting, yeah. You know, interesting stuff happening with in Philadelphia right across the board. I mean, everything from
it's amazing how the city's left movement has grown over the past few years.
Yeah. And then I also recently read an article that basically says, you know, not only is that kind of in part as a result of some of these kind of millennial-based movements, but that millennials may also be destroying Philadelphia's accent. So, you know, I guess, you know, take the good with the bad, I guess. You know, it's like, yeah, we get Fair Work Week. We get a kind of progressive in there, an attorney general or a district attorney. And then, you know, you're not going to be able to say water anymore. So,
water? Water? I still say water and yeah, coffee.
Oh, God, that came up. But that's really big. I mean, we haven't seen this. I mean, this is Philadelphia taking the lead kind of like on a nationwide level.
Yeah, I mean, they're the second largest city to do this. The other one, the only big one to do this is New York City. And I mean, it's amazing to see how this wouldn't have happened a few years ago. Like the amount of organizing and since the 2016 election with groups like Reclaim Philadelphia, Philly DSA, I mean, getting Krasner elected as district attorney, the city's left movement is very cohesive.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a pretty enlightening thing to see, considering you don't normally wouldn't see this with typical machine politics of Philadelphia.
Right.
Especially with Bob Brady running things and or Johnny Dock and stuff like that.
Well, this is a good point there too. What's also interesting there is to see a realignment between, say, progressive forces that are, say, you know, the non-labor progressive forces, you know, and by non-labor, I mean, you know, not based in the actual unions, right? Not that like DSA and other socialist organizations, for example, aren't kind of labor conscious or something like this, or pro-worker, not like that. But what I mean is like the power base in Philadelphia when it comes around labor issues, right, was based exactly what you're saying, and it still is to a certain degree. But to see this kind of move, right, where you see the kind of Fair Work Week legislation is, you know, again, this is comes out of the experience of millennials, like, and the kind of, you know, what the workplace actually looks like today, and to see that the left taking this up, and I have to say that I am sure that Gritty had a lot to do with this. I'm just going to say,
yes, there were a lot of Gritty signs there.
Yes, there were.
Like Gritty's watching you.
Gritty's watching you, exactly. And you know, but that kind of movement is also aligning with kind of movements within the labor movement to address things like, you know, $15 hour minimum wage, Fair Work Week legislation, kind of what has been happening and to the degradation of work within the service sectors and so on. So this is a kind of like a really awesome moment in seeing.
And it's a huge victory.
Yeah,
I mean, this is a huge labor victory, and you know, I mean, this is one of the biggest labor victories in the city in years.
Yep.
Probably.
Yep. I mean, I think about, you know, when I was looking at this stuff.
Because, like, and like, yeah, the thing about this is, just to add on to this.
Yeah.
I mean, like, yeah, the city cannot change its minimum wage, but they've passed, like, proclamations to do so.
Right.
But, like, this and paid sick leave are probably the two biggest, like, trophies within this, like, new movement of, like, labor conscious.
Right.
Like, organizations.
So, remind me again, Sean, why can't Philadelphia set its own minimum wage?
Because of preemption.
And what is preemption, Sean?
So preemption is what Republicans do, have these laws basically saying that the state can regulate these type of laws. So they try to do paid sick leave, got vetoed by the governor. They tried to do it. It is like that with minimum wage. And so Seth Grove is going to have introduced another bill going after municipalities changing these type of labor laws.
Right. So this is why I just wanted to put a button on that so people say this is where it's not because it's a national trend that or a national law that only the state can set minimum wage. It's because the GOP in this state passed a law specifically preventing municipalities from setting the minimum wage. Right. And it could be other ways. Right. Just like in New York City, they did it. Right. In other cities across the country, they've done this. Right. It's only because the Republicans have attempted to head this.
And you have Democrats who vote for this stuff. Who
yes,
believe
exactly. I was about to say, and Democrats and corporate Democrats who vote for this stuff. So, again, elections have consequences. Right.
Yeah. So
Anyways, I was thinking about, Sean, about this the Fair Work Week legislation, what that would mean. And I think about, for example, when I'm having to set my schedule, right, with two kids, right, getting my kids off to school, picking them up, making sure all this kind of stuff goes on. And I live in a relatively small town where my son can walk home from school, right, and be relatively safe. Right. I have to put in for my schedule, right, to plan my schedule and how my wife and I are going to kind of manage our time around this stuff. Like, you know, 6 months, at least more than that, really, but ahead of time, just in terms of setting the times of schedule and to kind of being on a schedule, especially if you have like more obligations than just spending your entire life going to work, right, and waiting around to work, that it would be. I can't even imagine the scenario about what it would look like if I had to basically be on call virtually 24/7 to be able to show up within 15, 20 minutes for a shift or not know what I was going to work with the next 3 days. That's crazy. So this is going to have a substantial, concrete, practical impact on hundreds and thousands of families, right?
Yeah.
And individuals across the city.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, it's amazing that we're like actually regulating this in 2018.
Yep. Yep.
Because I mean, in some like countries like in Europe, shit like this isn't an issue.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, next thing we got to watch out for the Seth Grove new legislation. It's called, I think it's the subtitle of it. What's it called? Bring Back the Breaker Boys. Just saying. Oh man. Anything else happen around the state, Sean?
No, nothing really. The Christmas tree was lit yesterday.
Oh, that's important. That's very important.
Yeah. Yes.
Was it a successful light?
Yes, yes. And there were some activists there as well who had a banner drop going after Governor Wolf's policies with the Department of Corrections.
Ah, were they dressed up like the Grinch? They should have been.
No, they were not, but...
Well, you know, I think... Governor Wolf, that kind of thing is ripe for intervention, especially with Governor Wolf's climate change policies. But we'll say whatever it is. Anyways, the one thing I do have to say, the last weekend was the Percocet tree lighting, right? I know it was not as much fanfare as that we see out in Harrisburg, but Percocet does claim to have the oldest continuous tree lighting ceremony in the country. So right there. But the cool thing about that, too, as well, just to give one more shout out to the folks at the Breadbox and Bakery. We talked about them on the podcast last week. They have their new location right at the corner of Market and 7th Street in Percocet, right across from where the Christmas tree is lit. The place was hopping all night long. It was so great to see so many people kind of coming out and supporting the local business. Congratulations to Ryman Maxwell, the guy who owns the place, and all of his staff. Their stuff, as like I always say, is fantastic. And I plug them any chance I can get. So that was kind of cool to be right here at the local tree lighting ceremony too as well. So cool. Anything else for the good of the order?
No, I'm good.
All right. Well, then with go ahead. Sorry.
There's one more thing.
Yep, go.
There were like 11 priests that were not named in a grand jury report back in August or July. The Supreme Court ruled that they're allowed to be remain redacted.
Are they really?
Yes.
I want to know who they are because I don't want to go near them. Not that I would anyways, but whatever. All right. Well, this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. We'll be right back with this week's Last Call. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. For the past 7 years, Raging Chicken Press has brought pull no punches, progressive reporting and commentary to the interwebs. Our long-form investigative pieces, stories that no access journalist wants to touch, or rollicking weekly podcasts strive to advance progressive movements and perspectives rooted in the struggles happening across the country or down the street. We've broken national stories and caused our share of discomfort in the halls of power. If we want a progressive future, we need progressive media. And you can help support Pull No Punches, homegrown progressive media today. Become a member of Raging Chicken Press for as little as $5 a month. Simply go to patreon.com/rcpress and choose your membership level. We need to make sure to keep the movement in the media and the media in the movement. Best way you can do that is to become a member of Raging Chicken today
by going to patreon.com/rcpress. Thank you for your energy, your encouragement, and your support. Keep up the fight. Yes, Lady Jibbles, let's call! Yes, ladies and gentlemen, it is today's last call, and just a little update on the Space Force for everybody. The Pentagon is now scrambling. If you recall, last week you said that the timeline was ticking for legislation to be kind of put in motion regarding the Space Force, and that's supposed to happen. Mike Pence is still saying that before the end of this year, December, that they're going to have their package together. However, there was a recent gathering of some space executives and policy experts this Thursday. Pentagon officials mostly sidestepped the Space Force issue. Undersecretary, this is from spacenews.com, Undersecretary of Defense for Research and Engineering, Michael Griffin, said he was not intentionally dodging the question, but simply does not know when or how a new military branch will be organized. Right? He says, quote, "Well, we made a recommendation, said he had no further details. I would be getting it way ahead of my headlights," said Griffin, "of how things shake out over the next year or two. I can't predict." Right? So Space Force is going crazy, but apparently it's causing some consternation in the Pentagon, because they're like, okay, if we're going to be mandated to do this, we have got no guidelines whatsoever. We're told that we've got a new branch of the military that we've got to organize, but we don't know how the hell this is going to happen. So I guess we're in a holding pattern. I can only imagine this guy like sitting in front
they're
of
They're probably just saying, like, I can't believe we got to fucking do this.
Yes, exactly.
Like you're exactly. Just sitting in the office and you're commiserating with your coworker. Like, do you fucking believe this?
Oh, my God. And it's supposed they're supposed to have it like getting rolling in 2019.
So. Yeah, we'll be right up on that. I think Space Force is like the new infrastructure week.
Yeah, totally, man. I mean, I love it. I love the fact that it's got its own theme song and everything too as well.
Space Force. Whenever bad news about the president comes out, it's just automatically infrastructure week.
Yeah, exactly.
You just change that to Space Force week.
Space Force week. Yep. Once again. Other space news. This is an anniversary. December 7th, 1972, is when NASA launched the last crew to land on the moon with the Apollo 17 mission, and that is it's kind of a cool marker, right? 1972. Just kind of think back, do the wavy line things back in 1972 when that happened. That was the last mission, and that is the other kind of initiative that is happening right now within NASA, in part with major support from Mike Pence and some other folks in the administration, Jim Bridenstine, who is now heading NASA, is to actually bring kind of commercial colonization to the moon. So, last time we were there, 1972, looks like maybe early 2020s that things will be going back. So we'll see. Want to give a shout out to our friends over Inside 254. I did not know this was coming, in part because my head has been so like nose to the grindstone of trying to get work done and stuff that I have not been paying attention to much of what's happening around me. Colleen Clemens and Amanda Morris, who are my colleagues at Kutztown University in the English department, and also had the amazing podcast called Inside 254. They brought that to a close about a week and a half, maybe 2 weeks ago now. And not because that they just whatever weren't getting they were getting great traction, they were getting great response. But when, as they talked about it in their final episode, they felt like, Inside 254 was launched in the aftermath of Trump being elected, when they attended the National Women's Studies Association conference. And they were back at the National Women's Studies Association conference and thought that, we've said what we need to say in this venue at this moment. Now it's time to move on and do something else. And Colleen said that, I like this. She said that, just happened to be that it was going to be episode 46. And so they closed it out with saying, just remember, everybody, after 45, there's 46. So, of course, 45 being referenced to Donald Trump. So congratulations on a great run Inside 254 podcast, and all their archives are still up there. There's some still amazing interviews, some of the best stuff that you're going to kind of encounter with some of the interviews that they did with around kind of about white privilege, about toxic masculinity, about a whole range of issues that have emerged. Are ongoing issues, but that became kind of people became acutely focused on, especially in the aftermath of the Trump victory. So it has been a great run. So you can go check them out, inside254.podbean.com, to check out all their archives. And congratulations on an awesome run. And we're going to miss you out here in pod space, everybody. Oh, cool. Meanwhile, closer down to Philadelphia and a major marker in the world, Wawa is getting in the beer business, apparently.
Times will never be the same. There is a Wawa now selling beer in Pennsylvania. That's it. We have crossed the event horizon.
Exactly. If there's so many firsts the past couple of years, like, who would have thought that Wawa would be, and they're partnering with, you said, 2SP Brewery?
Yes, 2SP's out Delaware County. They're actually getting some really good recognition. I have not had any of their beers yet, but they're supposedly like they're killing it. Mm-hmm. And they're making a name for themselves. And they did a collaboration with Wawa, making a coffee stout with the Wawa Winter Coffee.
There you go. And I do have to say, their kind of winter blend or holiday blend, however they put it, is actually pretty good for Wawa coffee. But so that's interesting. I mean, I guess if you're an up and coming craft brewer, to hit your your trailer to the wagon of Wawa, not exactly a bad move.
No, it's not.
So they were actually selling this out of the Wawa.
Yes, out of the Wawa in Chatsport. There's a line out around the corner. It was one of these like mega Wawas that have been popping up everywhere, and it's just every parking spot is full.
Oh my god! And when was it released?
Earlier this week.
So yeah. I don't know if there's any left. Do you know if there's any left after this?
I don't know.
So there we go. Sean is once again fully informed about what's happening down
there. I'm not paying attention to something that's happening 100 miles away from me.
But still.
I did not bother to call the Wawa and ask him if the beer was still left.
No, but it did come up in his Twitter feed. So, but so, you like Wawa coffee, Sean?
I actually dread when I have to get like Wawa coffee.
Yeah. Where do you get your coffee?
A couple places. Little Amps.
Little Amps, of course.
Then Elementary Coffee, which is in the market. Mm-hmm. And they do their own roast, which is really nice. So it's good having like two good roasters in the city.
Yeah, that's awesome. Do you actually buy their beans and stuff, or you just go there to get coffee?
I go there and I actually buy their beans, and I have them grounded up for my drip filter, and I make coffee every morning.
Oh, that's good. It's a good place. You've talked about that place a lot. I mean, good place to go get, good coffees, got good food, good juice.
Yeah. They... yeah.
I've just been holding that one for a while.
They also got give out buttons there too, which is really cool. So they have a little thing like free buttons, always supporting voting rights, women's rights, ACLU, DSA, and I got a couple buttons. Alt right equals wrong.
That's a great one.
Yeah, and they have one with a Nazi with a swastika, and the symbol going through it, no Nazis and stuff like that. I mean, they have those old punk buttons that you'll see around and all, which is pretty cool.
So. Yeah, speaking of old punk, the lead singer of the Buzzcocks died. So. Just
way to be a buzzkill.
A buzzkill? No.
Yeah.
No, but the point was, just throw that old punk stuff. But
I never listened to the Buzzcocks.
Yeah, I was never a big fan or follower of them and stuff like that. But they've got some really good songs, and they were kind of hugely influential and stuff. But the one thing to keep in mind, the big takeaway from what Sean was just saying, is that if you want a loyal customer among Sean Kitchen, give away free buttons. That's the key.
Yes.
But cool. I have to say that I've been getting my coffee from Just Coffee for a long time, in part because they get funding for the Majority Report sometimes and some other places. But I've known about them for a while, and in part, first put them on my radar is during the 2011 uprising in Wisconsin. Just Coffee was kind of really supplying coffee to the protesters and things like this. And they're a cooperative that actually worked with direct producers to produce kind of fair trade organic coffees. They worked with the Zapatistas, right, in Mexico, and to actually help support the movement. So they got a long, kind of very politicized history, and their coffee is awesome. And right now, just so you know, you don't need a code for this or anything like that. But if you went to their website, it's justcoffee.coop. That's justcoffee.coop. No com involved, but justcoffee.coop. You get like 30% off on and try some of their coffees. I mean, just I'll plug them when, you know, as we move into the holiday season. I just ordered a couple big 2-pound bags of whole beans just to have on here. So it's pretty cool. In other news, Free Will, once again, I don't know how they do it, but another double can released this weekend. They have the Tuku, I guess, Porter, which is coming to about 7%. And they describe that as having notes of Baker's chocolate, cocoa, and dark roasted coffee. It's kind of like they're kind of pitching it as kind of like a holiday type beer. And they're also coming out with the Eavesdrop, which is a sour IPA with Vic's Secret and El Dorado hops. That is a light one, more at kind of 5.5%. And they describe that one as a sour IPA, heavily dry hopped with Vic's Secret and El Dorado, leading to notes of ripe mango, tart passion fruit, papaya, and orange zest. So that will be available starting Saturday. That is Saturday the 8th at 12 p.m. noon. 12 noon. All right, there you have it.
That sounds like it's going
to
be good.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. You know, I think that now, like literally, I think I've mentioned this before. I don't know if I mentioned this on the show, but you know, there was a, like, I was getting like, they were producing some great beers and they're trying it. And frankly, I've been so tired for so long. Right. That I stopped drinking beer like during the week and even on the weekends for the most part, just because I was getting too tired. I'm actually got to go. I think, you know, I don't know if this is true or not, but I'm thinking that I might have sleep apnea too as well. So I'm going to have to try to, I'm going to do a test on that over break, because I've never been so exhausted in my life. And it's been really hard. I mean, life is complicated and complex as it is, right? I mean, I'm always kind of like a bit harried to begin with. It's kind of like my baseline. But I've never gotten to the point where I literally need to have to go to bed at like 9 o'clock at night sometime, just because, and I'm not rested in the morning. So that's it. So I just basically haven't been sampling a lot of this stuff, but hopefully now my semester, we just finished the last week of classes at Kutztown. Next week is finals. I got all my projects coming in over this weekend. And so it's going to be a bunch, like a week of grading. And then hopefully I'll get to back some of the sampling of the beer. So I definitely want to pick up some of this stuff this weekend. I'm really interested in the Porter and but you eavesdrop too as well. So hopefully I'll pick them up and let you know what I think. So cool. Anything else for the fun for the day, Sean?
No.
No. Any plans for the weekend?
Watching the Eagles. DSA
watching
meeting.
The Eagles. DSA meeting. Watching the Eagles. Awesome.
Yep.
Well, hey, man. I guess that's it. So, you know, here we go. This is, once again, we're wrapping this up. First week of December. Very, very cool. Well, I guess last week was the 30th, right? Yeah, so this is our first December show. We are approaching the end of the year. I want to remind everybody, look, if you can, this is a great time to kind of consider help supporting as you're looking at your end of the year giving. Consider Raging Chicken Press. No, we are not a nonprofit. No, you don't get a tax write-off for it. But yes, you will be helping keep the movement in the media and the media in the movement. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Thanks for sticking with us. And hey, we'll talk to you next week. In the meantime, go get yourself a juice. See ya!
Is President Trump right? That's a hard one. I want you to think about it before you respond. Or is there, in fact, ideas out there that would enable us to create millions of good-paying jobs as we move away from fossil fuels?
It's unsurprising that the response to any bold proposal that we have is to incite fear. To incite fear of loss, to incite fear of others, to incite fear of our future. But the only way we are going to get out of this situation is by choosing to be courageous.